Hello, thank you again for joining me. So we are going to investigate further the central question of the podcast, who or what are we? So very lightweight as usual. And to make it a bit more lightweight, we will investigate today the question of death. So how our own ending influences us, our behavior, how our denial of our own ending makes us make decisions, both in terms of political preference, as clinging to religious abstractions, things like that. And the guest with whom I will speak about this topic is a real expert. He probably wouldn't like the word expert because it implies some kind of superiority, which I'm quite sure he wouldn't like. But anyway, he has written the book The Worm at the Core, which goes really into the topic of our own death and the denial of our own death. And I think it was really interesting. Of course, I did because I'm biased, but I think it will be interesting for you as well. And I would encourage you to think on these things. So the podcast doesn't want to give an answer because that would be very arrogant. And of course, there is no one answer to the question, who or what we are. The question is also, is an answer useful? Yeah. So suppose there is an answer to the question, who or what you are, what are you going to do with it? I leave that up to you, but I think it's intellectually and spiritually, if I can use those words, it's valuable to just think on things yourself. And I hope these podcast series have helped you with that, and they will continue to help you with that. And I hope if you like it, that you know that I put a lot of time into these things because I have to prepare interviews, of course. I read the books of the people I meet. And also, like any street artist, you can call it, I want to do more with my passion. So if you find something valuable, please consider making a donation on the website 20angles.com so I can do more with my passion. And you can also share, of course, if you like. So please feel free to send me any feedback. I always like to go in discussions with people when they actually think on these things. And I hope you enjoy. I think it's an important question to ask who or what we are, because a lot of us go through life like in an almost neurotic mode, like just getting a job and going to work and doing whatever. And we never question, why am I doing something? What is making me do the things I do? And I think it's just important to look at that question from a lot of angles. And I don't think there's one right answer
No,
to the question.
absolutely. Which makes all the great questions. I don't think there's one right answer. And
Yeah.
because right now, it seems to me that the best way to disseminate ideas broadly is the work that you now do. And so
Ah, that's interesting.
I think this is important. And then when you were saying earlier, Stephen, that you think it's important to address these questions surrounding identity, I would say yeah. And this is just really a profoundly important and right-minded, fundamental aspect of the whole Western tradition. The
Yeah,
idea.
in the Eastern tradition, it's a bit different, and
That's
they
right.
talk about the ego and the self a lot more.
Sure. But just this idea to know thyself, I think is a good one, even if it makes us pause long enough to think about why that's so difficult. And I'm a social psychologist, and when I talk to young students, I'm like, well, what's social psychology? And I'm like, all right, to state the obvious, it's one part psychology. And that surrounds the question of who am I? And then it's another part is sociology, and that surrounds the question of, well, what's happening around me? And
Yeah.
at the risk of sounding simple-minded, those should be the two most important questions that one might ask. And the only point that, social psychologists and sociologists have been fond of making for hundreds of years is that those two questions, which appear to be superficially disparate, are in fact inextricably connected. You are in part a reflection of what's happening around you. And of course, what's happening mm-hmm. around you is a reflection of who you are or consider yourself to be. So that's just my way of applauding the enterprise and the way that you're choosing to distribute these ideas. I think it's timely and important.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so people would argue that it's a bit philosophical. Actually, it's very philosophical, and in the end, the philosophy of a question that doesn't really have an answer maybe might be futile. But I think it's like important that we are aware of like certain mental constructs we have and that we use on a daily basis that we just have never made a definition for. And I think there's a lot of self-help as well out in the world, and I don't really like that much, because I think a human being can only help himself. Like, you can read a book about what helped another person, but I think if you question yourself, then you might be able to help yourself.
I think yes.
By reading books, you will not get there.
That's right. And a good point, and I happen to agree with you. One of the most dangerous places to get help is from a self-help book. Most of them are quintessentially useless in that they're thinly veiled efforts to generate revenue on behalf of their proponents. And it's actually frightening to go into any bookstore back in the days when they existed, and you go to the psychology part, and it's just all these smiling people, well-dressed and well-tanned, saying, you can be happy without doing anything by mm-hmm. buying my book. And the woman who wrote the first self-help book is Karen Horney, who was one of Freud's disciples, and she wrote the book in the 1940s. And the book's called Self-Analysis. And her point is that, I'll write a book about it. I think it's important. I think it can be done. But not from reading books. And so I love her book because she says two things. One is that genuine change is not easy and often painful. So if you say to yourself, I want to be a better person, and now I am, and that was easy, her point would be, no, you're probably not a better person. And her other point was, if you understand my book, you will get to know yourself in the process of life itself. And that means you put the book down and you actually go out and start to live and mingle with your fellow mm-hmm. humans. And so point well taken.
Yeah, I think you're right about the thing that we need some pain in order to progress. And I think a lot of self-help books or things you read on the internet are about positive psychology. And if you think about five things you're grateful for every day, your life will be happy and bliss. But I think like from an evolutionary perspective, maybe we're not even made to be happy. We're made to survive. Our senses are made to survive. Our senses are not even made to understand the universe. So yeah, I think there's a big gap between people's expectations about life and just the reality in which life has evolved, or at least what's the current knowledge about that. So,
excellent points. Happiness way overrated, if for no other reason than, as you noted, we weren't constructed from an evolutionary standpoint to be content. In fact, it's often from a purely gene's eye view, happy people may not be the best way to move snippets of genetic material into future mm-hmm. generations. And moreover, I think in our incessant pursuit of happiness, we're reluctant to entertain the collateral proposition, which is that in order to have extraordinary joy, which I do think is an intrinsic part of the human condition as a result of being aware that we're here, you have to be open to the other side of the emotional spectrum, which is the same, the same awareness that makes us enthusiastic about being alive can also be quite dreadful when it reminds us of the fact that we'll not always be here.
Yeah, I think like another thing that's very modern these days is meditation, and I do it myself, but people only want to do, they want to have like bliss and joy, but they don't want to have the very dark and painful realizations that come about when you really allow everything to come to you. And yeah, I think if you want to be happy, you also, yeah, we'll need to like maybe sometimes even invite pain a little bit into your life.
That's correct. Not in a persistently masochistic fashion for its own sake, but rather as you're intimating. Yeah, I think it is to render one open to the vast range of possibilities that we are afforded by virtue of our rich emotional life as human beings.
I think it's interesting, like the new science on psychedelic drugs now, because like for people with treatment resistant depression, there's like a lot of promise, for instance, with psilocybin. I think what that shows is that sometimes you need to experience some pain or like some painful self insight before you can get anywhere. And then it's not the psychologist doing the job in the end. The psychologist might guide you in these kind of sessions as long as that's legally allowed. So, but yeah, you have to do all the hard work yourself. And it, you know, I find it interesting.
Yes, it makes a ton of sense. And actually, the recent work on psychedelics, which I think is very promising, it just harkens back to some of the original research. So a lot of young folks in the U.S., they think that the psychedelics were developed in the 1960s for young people to go to music festivals. But they were originally... Yeah, not a bad idea, but they were originally synthesized to be used in therapy. So a guy named Stanislav Grof in the 1950s, he used LSD in therapy. And he showed just
I know Albert Hoffman was the guy that accidentally discovered it, but then I don't know the story.
Yeah, well, then there's a lot of folks who saw it as being potentially very useful therapeutically. And what Grof found in a book called Realms of the Unconscious, and then there's a subtitle about LSD research, is just what you said. And he did what's called psycholytic therapy, where he gave people who were being supervised by psychiatrists repeated very high doses of LSD. And what he found is that there was a progression. And the original experiences were quite externally focused, like, ooh, look at those lights or look at those sounds. But then they would become progressively more internally focused, at first on aspects of our lives that we were currently concerned about or unhappy with. And I think what Grof called them was core experiences. And what he found, at least clinically, with hundreds of observations, is that, yeah, the first thing that had to happen in order to get to this blissful transcendence is that you had to explicitly come to terms with your current concerns, which just gets back to your point, and that is that psychodynamically, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, I just want to be happy, while systematically blocking off any possible direct confrontation with the more unpleasant aspects of being alive.
Yeah, like I've experienced in the Amazon, the psychedelic plant, ayahuasca.
Yes.
And it was quite similar to what you said, actually. First, it was quite fun, and I saw like everything in a cartoonish way.
Yeah.
But my goal was also really to get into myself as far as I have a self. But then it started to get quite quite personal, and I really started to see how I had like this neurosis in like an automatic way as a way of protecting me, maybe because of previous experiences. And I could kind of see love into that. And I think that's what the psychedelic experience did for me, is that I always saw it like as a bad way. Like, these are my bad parts of my personality. But you tend to see that even your bad parts are actually, it might sound hippie, but out of some basic love or goodness you have inside. And it can be a weird feeling, like something can be very, very painful. But at the same time, you can like feel some love and maybe even some bliss inside the same thing. So it's, for me, it was really interesting. And I think it can help a lot of people. But in Belgium, we're still very far behind from legalizing these things, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens on this side of the pond. I'm quite familiar with that research, though, and it looks very promising. A single experience in very ill, terminally ill people or folks who are profoundly depressed is showing to have really enduring and very positive consequences. And of course, the trick in my mind, I've no objection to the use of psychedelics. I go way back. I gobbled them like candy when I was a kid. And I go back to the days of Aldous Huxley, you know, with Doors of Perception, when he speculated in the 1960s that there'll come a moment when taking psychedelics would just be part of your education, that every child would maybe do it.
It's definitely more than a year of school's material that you get into.
There you go.
Do one trip if it's valuable.
That's right. And this is not to say that it should be done indiscriminately or in the absence of careful supervision, but I'm of the view that it could be quite useful. And not necessarily the only way to procure these kinds of self-revelatory experiences. So I think a guy named Andrew Weil wrote a book called The Natural Mind in the 1970s. And his point was and still is, psychedelics can be very potent and powerful. So can the consumption of marijuana, but so could running marathons or meditating, or one's own idiosyncratic ways of becoming more dynamically attuned to oneself. And that could be in the context of our hobbies, your podcasts, you know, me gardening or walking my dog. I just like
you're
the
like
idea.
You like to stay doing sports.
Yes, absolutely. So I think there's a lot of ways to get to the same endpoint.
Yeah, maybe the psychedelics are like a shortcut into getting some feeling of what's deeply inside you that's driving you,
that's
or maybe
right.
Holding back a little bit.
Yeah, and the only danger, as the Wheel guy points out, is the all too American tendency to want to bypass time and effort. You know, it's like, oh, give me a pill that will produce these experiences. And Wheel's point is that the experience is a multiplicative function of the substance and the person consuming it. And he just wants to highlight that it's not as simple as give me a pill or give me a mushroom and I'll be enlightened 12 hours later. The people that tend to have the most transformative experiences as a result of these kinds of efforts are ones that are psychodynamically prepared, whether they're aware of it or not.
Yeah, because it can be dangerous, because when I did the ayahuasca retreat, it was a really good retreat, like with supervision and guards, but there was one guy, he was ex-military, and he had post-traumatic stress disorder, and there was some point in the ceremony where another guy started snoring and he really went mental on him.
Yep.
And he threatened to kill the guy because of him, he didn't get any life-changing visions. And he was really like into a psychosis, and they had to escort him out. So I think if you're unwilling to invite or accept some things that come to you, and you're not under the right guidance, because a shaman is not a psychologist in the end.
That's right.
I think it can be very dangerous.
It is very dangerous. And what I would say is that should never have happened, because the hallucinogens are potent amplifiers of pre-existing psychological states. And so a PTSD mm-hmm. person, you know, which is literally characterized by hypervigilance and an inability to stop reflecting on the trauma. You know, that's bad to begin with. And if you multiply that mm-hmm. by several yeah. hundred orders of magnitude with the hallucinogen, yeah, that was bound not to end all that well.
Yeah, it was probably one of the most scary things that I ever seen. Like he went completely crazy. And then I think the shaman was not even that aware that there was such a thing as PTSD. So for me, it was quite obvious from the beginning when the guy told his story. But yeah, there's also always some hocus pocus involved with these things, certainly if they're like from ancient traditions. And yeah, it can be dangerous. I experienced myself.
Yes.
What do you think about like meditation in terms of getting to know who or what we are, like at the core of our being, or what drives us?
Well, I can't. That's a great question that I'm not equipped to speak with authority, either by virtue of experience or mm-hmm. academic background. But what I can say is that, you know, there's literally millenniums of historical and philosophical traditions that suggest that it should be quite useful for such pursuits. Having said that, though, there's spirited, as there should be, disagreement amongst both meditators as well as people who study them as to why that might be the case. And so there are some folks who argue that the essence of meditation is actually respiration, and mm-hmm. that what is ultimately underlies the capacity to narrow our attention, to abandon our ego in the Eastern sense of the word, long mm-hmm. enough to dispose of our culturally constructed caricatures of ourselves that we usually put forward to the world around us. You know, our personality, which is derived from the Latin word persona or mask, that it's only when you shed that, and I like that you can come to know yourself. All right, well, some people say, hey, it's really about breathing, that what's happening is that common to all meditative techniques is a reduced respiration rate, and you magnify the volume of air that you inhale and exhale. All right, that in mm-hmm. turn is known to activate the parasympathetic nervous system, which is an anxiety buffer. And so one possibility is that through meditation, you're manipulating your breathing in a way that relaxes you, and that in turn diminishes death anxiety. And when you're not anxious, it is much easier to step back and to view yourself more intimately and accurately. All right, that's one possibility. Other folks say, no. Breathing's part of it, but it is also, you know, metaphorically, you know, clearing the psychological debris away from your psychological landscape. To give you what Martin Heidegger, the philosopher, he called it, you know, he's like, it gives you a broader horizon that through meditation, or today I think they use the term mindfulness as kind of a generic term, and I'm fine with that, but that this is much more than breathing. It may be the result of breathing, but it's only by the capacity to just stop our normal everyday lives, which has us pelted with, you know, just an unbroken onslaught of sensory images. Well, you mm-hmm. need to do that. And when you can, you get a whole new view of the world. And so mindful people, they tend to be more grateful. They also tend to be more humble. And there's research based on our work that demonstrates that mindfulness, which I'm going to equate with meditation momentarily, that's also a potent way to minimize existential anxieties. Given the work that I do, which is mainly to investigate how the uniquely human awareness of death causes potentially debilitating existential terror, that we tend to manage by repressing anxiety, well, that's not the best way to get to know yourself. But mindfulness and gratitude and humility all reduce death anxiety and eliminate the defensive reactions to death reminders that we find in our experiments. And so I think that that's a good direction for those of us that are lucky enough to be in a position to be both grateful and humble.
Actually, it's also kind of a luxury thing to do meditation or mindfulness. It means probably you don't have that much big problems in comparison to a lot of other people in other parts of the world. And then we want to be mindful. And it has become kind of a status game, I think, to be mindful. And then it loses all its purpose.
Well, okay, don't get me started. Every good idea on earth has been reduced to rubble once the people who make money for a living glob onto it. Yeah. And so that's unfortunate, because once it's turned into a commercial commodity, it runs the risk of being no better and even worse than the self-help books that I was bemoaning at the beginning of our conversation.
Yeah, it's interesting because most of your work is on that we are aware of the fact that we are aware, and that makes us also aware of our own death, of course. So it's interesting that you say that we have like some core anxiety inside us. Do you feel like most of us, either because of this death that's approaching or because of other reasons, are like in some continuous state of neurosis and going through life in like an almost like a chicken without a head? Or do you think I'm exaggerating?
I think you are not exaggerating, except with the stipulation that neurosis be seen as a continuous variable that ranges from relatively slight to demonically oppressive. Our work is just, it's literally based on an idea that Darwin pondered, and that was a big in Freud's work, and that's that we are innately anxious creatures by virtue of the fact that I think the biologists call it neoteny, and that's just the idea that we're born in a profoundly immature and hopelessly dependent state relative to other creatures. So fish can have babies and the baby fish swim away. Cat can have a kitten, and 6 weeks later the cats are on their own. The human infant, by comparison, is a pathetic monstrosity, a respiring pincushion, unable to sit up or do anything instrumentally effective. And so what Freud proposed, what John Bowlby, the guy who formed attachment theory, said is, look, it makes sense that if you're born and you can't do anything, that it is highly adaptive, even if manifestly unpleasant, to be anxious. All of the non-anxious creatures throughout human history are probably fossilized on the side of cave walls.
It's evolutionary interesting to be anxious,
correct.
If you're helpless.
There you go. And so anxiety has the paradoxical effect of, on the one hand, being profoundly unpleasant, and on the other hand, being arguably utterly necessary in the service of survival. And so, like anything, the question now becomes, well, what's the appropriate amount of anxiety? No anxiety, and you run the risk of being a narcissistic sociopath. Too much anxiety, you know, and you become a caricature from a Woody Allen film, or, you know, you're at the high end of neuroticism.
Yeah, both are interesting.
That's right. But then there's the middle ground. The argument here is that anxiety about life and anxiety about death are, A, not going to go away, and mm-hmm. B, when we try to repress them, rather than just accept that it's a quote normal part of the human condition, that's when it comes back to bear malignant and bitter fruit. So it's not death anxiety necessarily that cripples us as humans, although it does some at its extreme. It is, in our view, our inability to even consciously entertain the fact that we might be anxious about death. And when that happens, that's when other things come up that are quite unpleasant. And so in our research, we find that when we remind people that they're going to die, in a very subtle way, like, for example, when we interview them standing in front of a funeral home, or we mm-hmm. flash the word death for 28 milliseconds. It's so fast that you can't even see
it. Like subliminal.
Or even if we just like bury in a bunch of questionnaires a couple of questions. Well, what do you think about the prospect of yourself dying? Those are just really subtle manipulations. And yet, when we do that, what we find is that people hate other people who are different. They sit further away from people who look different. They're more willing to harm people that look different. They vote for different kinds of political leaders, like Hitler and Orange Hitler, Donald Trump. They become.
Yeah, I was thinking of him.
Oh, of course. And they become alienated from their bodies and from the natural environment. It turns us into insatiable consumers with unlimited desires for money and stuff, and it amplifies existing psychological disorders. And so in our view, it's death anxiety isn't so much the problem as much as our unwillingness to individually and collectively admit that it is a universal human concern, so that we can come up with more mature and effective ways of managing it as individuals and societies.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like you mentioned Trump. Do you think because he is very much into, when he speaks, he talks a lot in extremes, do you think because of that, people irrationally overvalue him in some way because it gets them emotionally?
Yes. So Trump is, he's a second-rate Hitler. What I mean by that is that Hitler was a lot smarter and knew more of what he's doing. Trump may be more effective because he's got the internet and Fox News and Twitter. But basically, there's a guy named Eric Hoffer who wrote a book called The True Believer after World War II, where he was trying to understand the Hitlers and the Mussolinis, populist, charismatic leaders. And what Hoffer said is that people, and not all of us, in the wake of psychological insecurity, we sometimes become overly attracted to what Max Weber called a charismatic leader, a sociologist at the beginning of the 20th century. Weber said when the historical shit hits the fan, when there's wars, depressions, maybe an epidemic now, that we are comforted by a seemingly larger than life individual who claims that they're divinely ordained to rid the world of evil. And what the Hoffer dude said is that what populists do is they take these basic fears that are magnified by historical circumstances and they transform them into hate. They just say, look, I'm the only one that could bring back the good old days when things were great. And let me direct your attention to these other folks that we're going to declare the all-encompassing repositories of evil. And so what is psychodynamically, what the Trumps of the world do is they take fear and they convert it into hate. And they say, here's the people you need to hate. For Hitler, it was the Jews and the gypsies. For Trump, it's the Chinese. It's Islam. It's black people. It's anybody who knows how to read and shit like that. and he has mastered the idea. And what Hitler said is, here's the deal. You need to. It was Goebbels who said, look, it's easy to get people to support you. You just use fear. You just say, look, here's the enemies. They're attacking mm-hmm. us, and only I can keep you safe. And Steve Bannon, who's the guy that advised Trump, he said in an interview in 2017, he's like, look, it's not rational discourse that brings people to the polls. It's fear and anger. Build the wall. Lock her up. I'm going to make America great again. That's what's going to get people's attention and allegiance. And yeah. in Mein Kampf, Hitler writes about, you know, look, here's what you got to do. You got to speak in monosyllabic, short, repetitive utterances. And Trump speaks at a fourth grade level. You've got to keep people angry and hateful. And well, that's what Trump has done masterfully. But his particular genius is, and I mean genius in quotes.
Yeah, that's like the question with him. Is he, let's say his IQ is probably not the highest, even though he claims otherwise, but in terms of maybe EQ or the fact of manipulating people,
he's quite brilliant. I'm quite certain that
at least his entourage.
Yeah, he's a moron in terms of his intellectual capacity, but there's evolutionary psychologists these days that point out that in human communities, there's some people who lead by wisdom, and there's some people who lead by dominance, which is just an mm-hmm. appeal to fear. When the primatologist Jane Goodall saw Trump in 2015, her immediate reaction was, I've seen that before in chimps. You know, he's just testosterone-infused primate. But you don't need to have a forebrain to be incredibly attuned, as you put it, emotionally. And this is his genius, is that he realized, and I say realize in quotes, that you don't even have to pretend to refer to truth or logic, because that doesn't really influence anybody. So he's taken, and he's also in his own way aware of the fact that Americans are just quintessentially ignorant. We have a longstanding tradition of finding knowledge and expertise offensive. I like how Frank Zappa put it. After Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, when he said the American public treats intelligent behavior as if it were some sort of hideous physical deformity. And so we were already...
It's recognizable in Belgium as well.
It's not just here. But you know, so we already have Americans really not being prepared for the civic responsibilities of being citizens in a democracy. But we've just lobotomized them. Most Americans haven't read a book in the past year. One-fourth of the people in America, or is it one-tenth? Anyway, it's too high. They can't even name the title of a book. And so,
spectacular.
Yeah, and most Americans, they don't get any news from reputable sources. They get it from Fox News or Twitter or Facebook. So here you have this guy that makes no pretense at truth. He lies more frequently than inebriated people urinate. And because it doesn't matter. And he's exploiting the 24-hour news cycle because he just barrages people, especially his followers, with bullshit so that they never have the time or energy to step back long enough to ponder the possibility that what he's saying is generally nonsense. Anyway, it's quite effective and, in my opinion, quite scary, because what our research has shown is that death anxiety increases support for charismatic leaders in general, and for people like Hitler and George W. Bush and Trump in particular. Mm-hmm. So as horrific as it sounds, what's going on right now in the world, that being the pandemic and the collapse of the economy, on top of the fact of the civil unrest in the form of the race riots that we're now witnessing, most people hate that stuff, but Trump is loving it because in his gut, he understands that that's probably his best hope for re-election is to maintain.
Yeah, and it gives him more screen time, eh? A pandemic that gets people crazy, and then
there you go.
Racism and riots.
Yep, it's a winner for him.
Yeah, it's similar, what you say, to the situation in Belgium, because in Belgium, extreme right has also won a lot of votes, and what they do also very well is they just, by using social media, they can know very well which people have which frustrations, and
that's
then
right.
They just tap into it, and they tap into their fear, like you say. And I also think, like, a little bit like in game theory, if everybody plays according to a certain rules, and there's four or five people who think I'm going to play according to different rules, then those people, they win magnificently. It's just not, it's not a fair game.
No, it's not. I think you've really made a fine point, and without sounding like a paranoid conspiracy theorist, although I am in this regard, Trump's people are way ahead at micromanaging misinformation. And so my understanding is that one of the main reasons that Trump wants to keep doing these big rallies in public is more than just that he's a malignant narcissist who wilts the minute he doesn't have people clapping and yelling, is that his folks, when people walk into his rallies with cell phones, they're grabbing the information from their cell phones, which then allows them to identify a whole lot about them, where they live, how old they are, their patterns of consumption, their Facebook habits. And so it's getting to the point where you can say, oh, yeah, here's a woman who lives in the suburbs and her main concern is the safety of her children. So we can lie to her about black people storming the suburbs in Ohio in order to do this. Somebody else you might realize is more concerned about religious freedom. So you can lie to them about Joe Biden wanting to take away your Bibles.
It's like personalized politics that we get by social media.
Yeah, and that's where we're at. Is it's going to be very personalized, and it's going to be modifiable in real time. And it has ominous implications for everything in the future.
Yeah. What I also think is that not every human being is the smartest. Like the average IQ is 100.
Yeah.
So it means that there's a lot of people with not that much intellect. So they are very easy to influence. And I think if you're higher educated, I think higher educated people probably vote less for people like Trump.
Absolutely.
But yes, some people are just like, how I don't know how to say in English, but they're like, they're an easy target for
kind of
strategies, I think.
That's right. In psychobabble, they don't process information through a central system. They engage in what's called peripheral processing, which is usually that they defer to folks that they admire. And the good news is that it may not be a function of intelligence so much as education. There's some studies that I like that show that you can teach elementary school children to recognize and reject bullshit. And so we can teach people to be more critical thinkers. The kind of cynical reaction to that, I don't know if it's cynical, but there are some economists who point out that capitalism as we know it would fall apart in a matter of minutes if we actually had thoughtful people who made rational decisions based on what was literally in their own self-interest. So if we only bought things that we really wanted and needed, then the economy would fall apart in a day. Additionally,
I also think if everybody was like a freelancer or a free agent instead of an employee and kind of a slave sometimes, I think it would be a big difference, because then you have to keep the person happy because they have multiple options. But if you're an employee in a company and you have a car and a cell phone, you're like the children that you mentioned, like you're dependent for almost for your existence to this company. And I think a lot of people might be addicted to their paycheck, and they would make themselves like to the most extreme of miserables just to get that monthly paycheck.
Yeah, there you go. I couldn't say it better. We get Kierkegaard, he called it being tranquilized by the trivial. And it's just this idea that, yeah, we get enmeshed in our day-to-day activities. And, you know, what some theorists point out is that in a lot of places, as soon as women get to vote, and as soon as there's a critical mass of educated citizens, then almost invariably, most societies move to what would be called a social democracy, where you have guaranteed health care and access to education. And the United States is quite singular in this regard. We have resisted providing health care or basic social services on the grounds that it is an infringement of our freedom. And yet in most other places, it is the most immediate exercise of political freedom is to guarantee that those assurances are put in place. So my view, you know, again, at the risk of sounding glib, is that the, you know, people who like the way things are now in the United States, they're the most vigorous champions of keeping people ignorant and ensuring that education does nothing to raise awareness of ourselves or our surroundings. It's not a good look for the future.
So this was the ending, but good news, because this was only part one, I decided to make it into two parts, because I don't want to be responsible for any brain overload with my listeners. So stay tuned for episode two, and you can stay tuned by going to 20angles.com and signing up for the newsletter. I send very, very few newsletters, so no spamming anytime soon. And as I said before, consider me a street artist who likes his passion. And if you want to continue to listen to my work and contribute to it, you can make a donation on my website. And yeah, that's about it. Feel free to contact me about the contents of today's discussion if you have thoughts that came to your mind, because I think it's very valuable to do this. And it's also the goal of the podcast to just make people think about things which they might not think about. So yeah, that's it. Bye.